Thank you so much.
Does that count toward my talk time?
No.
My name is Laura Zeifer. I became a Christian, first heard the gospel when I was 21 years old, committed my life to Christ after a supernatural experience followed by examining the evidence to make sure that I had encountered the God I thought I had encountered, the God of the Bible, as opposed to the God of Islam or some other religion. And I went to Denver Seminary a couple years after becoming a Christian. Absolutely loved it there. Three of the most fun and intellectually challenging and exciting years of my life. I've been in vocational ministry most of my adult life, and I've ministered in 35 different countries approximately over 25 years, a lot of Muslim majority countries. I've ministered in for about 5 years in the refugee community of Clarkston, Georgia, just on the outskirts of Atlanta. I've ministered in Afghanistan, Egypt, Jordan, to Muslims in and recent converts to Christianity in Burundi, in India, all over the place. So it's been an incredible joy and honor that I actually never sought to get into. When I was 21 years old, I was asked if you could be, I had just become a Christian, I was asked if you could be a missionary anywhere, where would you go? And I said, United States. And they're like, okay, that doesn't count. Where else? And I was like, I don't want to be a missionary. I don't know. I don't care. And they said, well, okay, if you could go anywhere on vacation, where would you go? And I said, Florida. And they're like, aren't you from Florida? Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not kind of a, you know, adventurous. I wasn't, you know, wanting to travel the world and minister to people, but God does things we don't expect. So I'm currently studying at Birmingham Theological Seminary in Alabama. It's an online program for my doctorate, Doctor of Ministry in Public Theology. And I am writing my dissertation now. My proposal was just accepted, so writing my dissertation on, thank you, on how to effectively interact and speak truth to non-believers and also disciple believers well, without simply resorting to quoting scripture to people who don't already believe the scriptures. How else can we find common ground to get conversations started? And natural law is a big part of that. So that, yeah. And so I am going to speak on the evidence for the crucifixion. And if I have similar problems as Dr. J had, I'll just do it without it. It's not a huge deal. So I'm having even more problems than he had because I can't even get it started. Oh, that's it. It's up there.
Yeah, but make it full screen. It's not showing there. Okay. I don't know why. This is very strange. The screen setting change. Which one is it? This?
Yeah.
It's not going to be there.
Oh, nice. All right. And I can just, whoops, it disappeared from here.
It kind of come right.
Oh, great. And I can just do this button to move it forward.
Down.
Oh, down. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. All right. A few few years ago, I was visiting a Muslim friend in Washington, D.C., and we decided to go to the National Art Museum. At one point, we came to this room that was filled with paintings of biblical scenes. Adam and Eve in the garden, Abraham sacrificing his son, Potiphar's wife accusing Joseph, David meeting Abigail, Daniel in the lion's den. And as we walked along and looked at these paintings, my friend would ask me, oh, what is that a painting of? What is that depicting? And I would tell her, and she would say, oh, yeah, we have that in the Quran, too. Well, then we came to a painting of depicting the crucifixion. And she said, who is that? And I told her, well, that's Jesus on the cross, having lived a sinless life, taking on the wrath of the Father, to pay the penalty for our sins, so that we could be reconciled with God, so that we could be adopted into his family, so that we could live with him in heaven in the new earth. She said, Jesus didn't die, and he wasn't even crucified. She was expressing the most common belief among Muslims, that is, that Jesus was not killed or crucified, and this comes from the Quran. 4:155-158, I'm paraphrasing this first part, but it's because it's quite long, but it says basically the Jews were condemned for breaking their covenant, for rejecting Allah's signs, for killing the prophets unjustly, and for boasting. Here's where it's a quote, exact quote. The Jews were boasting, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the messenger of Allah. I'll take a brief second there. Do you see anything wrong with that? If the Jews had thought he was the Messiah, they would not have killed him. So the Jews would never have been saying, yay, we killed the Messiah. Makes no sense. But I'll continue, because I'm going to point out other problems. But they neither killed nor crucified him. It was only made to appear so. Even those who argue for this crucifixion are in doubt. They have no knowledge whatsoever, only making assumptions. They certainly did not kill him. Rather, Allah raised him up to himself, and Allah is almighty, all wise. So according to the Quran, Jesus was not crucified or killed, but rather what happened was Allah raised Jesus directly to himself. But if Jesus didn't die, then he didn't pay the penalty for our sins, right? And so we are left to pay for them ourselves. So over the next 45 minutes or so, I want to look at this question, whether or not Jesus was crucified. For most of the beginning of it, I think this may be helpful for and encouraging for your own walk if you are not aware of some of this information. It also can come in handy and be very useful for interacting with Muslims. A very good friend of mine who is who Dr. J mentioned, actually, who is one of the best cultural polemicists in the world, came to know Christ in part by looking at the historical evidence for the crucifixion and realizing that Muslims are actually wrong, that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. So this is valuable for that. But if you feel like, oh, this is a whole lot of information, how would I ever get this across to a Muslim or anything like that? There will be a couple of points where I'll say, this is what I bring up with Muslims. So the things that we're going to look at, multiple ancient sources, and Dr. J just did a great job of talking about those. I'll probably move through those pretty quickly. Four additional criteria for historical reliability. There are different aspects of documents and such that historians consistently look at to determine whether they are reliable or just fabricated. We'll see that there is a coherent historical context, that the Jesus' crucifixion fits the historical context of first century Jerusalem under the reign of the Roman Empire. Crucifixion was a common practice at that time, and the accounts that we have in the Gospels fit the other accounts that we have about how crucifixions were done and things like that. We have archaeological evidence that indicate that the Gospels are reliable. We have scholarly consensus, which in and of itself is not necessarily all that helpful, but we'll look at people who have devoted their lives to trying to destroy Christianity and draw everybody away from Christ, who say, well, yeah, obviously Jesus was killed by crucifixion. So they have no inherent incentive to agree to the crucifixion, except that it's just overwhelmingly attested and historically confirmed. And then we'll look at Muslim explanations for what happened and see the extreme shortcomings of those. So the crucifixion of Christ is considered by many historians, most historians, to be the best attested fact in all of ancient history. It is without a doubt one of the best attested facts in all of ancient history. We have written testimony that is that Jesus died on the cross. It's virtually unanimous among ancient historians. We've got testimony from Jews and Gentiles, from Roman officials, lay people, philosophers, people of all different backgrounds. And again, virtually all scholars today agree on the crucifixion. So who are some of these ancient non-Christian sources? Let's look at those. For sake of time, I probably won't read what they've written, but Josephus lived in the first century. He is considered a very reliable historian. He affirmed that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. He affirmed, of course, that crucifixion was practiced at that time, and he referred to crucifixion as the extreme penalty, which one of these other historians actually then later said Jesus succumbed to the extreme penalty. We have Marabar Serapion, who was also in the first century. Cornelius Tacitus lived 56 to 120 AD, and he was a Roman orator and public official. He mentioned Jesus' death when he was writing about how the Roman Emperor Nero had blamed the Christians for the burning of Rome. And he wrote this: Nero fastened the guilt of the burning of Rome and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty, so again, that's crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. So this is a non-Christian Roman official who is saying, who is affirming in very early on, in, you know, lived in the first century, early second century, that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Lucian of Samosata, the Jewish Talmud, these are additional sources that we have. We also have Christian sources, and usually when I bring up the Christian sources, people will say, well, we can't trust the Christian sources because they're biased. How do we respond to that? Someone's just like, oh, I don't even want to consider what's in the Bible because they're biased, or what any Christians had to say, or the Christian fathers, fathers of the church that Dr. J mentioned. Well, first of all, everyone is biased. Everyone has some sort of thought or opinion on the topic about which they are writing. Otherwise, they wouldn't write about it. The question is not, is this author biased? The question is, was this author so biased for some reason that they are unreliable in what they wrote? And what we see is that the authors of the Gospels are found to be extremely reliable. Another thing to keep in mind, the Bible is not a single source. I was talking to a guy last year who told me, he said, oh, you can't trust the Bible. The guy who wrote that book was biased. I said, the guy who wrote the book, eh? Who might that be? And he goes, oh, I can't remember his name, and I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I said, please do that. I would love that. Promise. And I saw this guy every day, so I knew I was going to see him the next, you know, probably the next day. So next day I said, hey, did you find out who wrote the Bible? And He said, yes, yes. His name was King James. He was from England. Excellent, excellent. Let's talk about that. So, and we did. Great conversations. But yeah, it's important to remember that the Bible is not a single source. It's a collection of 66 books written by about 40 different authors over about 1,500 years. And the authors were from different backgrounds, different education levels, different languages, all sorts of different cultures. And so I actually find it to be more miraculous that all these different people from different places and times and backgrounds over 1,500 years could write these 66 different books and have them cohere into one unified, overarching story that explains reality and creates a worldview that fits with reality. That's amazing. That's remarkable. The New Testament alone is a collection of 27 books written by about 9 different authors. And they were included in the Bible because they were written very early. They were written by those who were considered reliable, and they were embraced and accepted as true by the early church, the first Christians. It's also important to remember that there were no Christians before Christ. There was no one who said, oh, we're Christians, and this Christian teacher is coming along, so we need to agree with the Christian because we're Christians. That didn't happen. They were Jews who already thought they had the truth, and who had to be persuaded by the evidence, by what they heard and saw, that Jesus was their awaited Messiah. And he did not come in all the ways they expected him to. So we are reading sources from people who were persuaded by the evidence, and that, of course, is a very valuable resource. So who are these Christian sources? Of course, we have the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We've got the independent testimony of Paul. We also have next century Christian authors, Papias, Polycarp, Clement, and Ignatius. When we contrast that with Islam, which is one source by one man who claimed to have revelations from God through the angel Gabriel with no witnesses at all. Even his own contemporaries believed he was making things up. And they questioned him. They asked him to do some miracles to confirm that he was delivering a message from God, just as prophets of the past had done. And he admitted that he could do none. He said, my miracle is that the Quran is just so beautiful. It's inimitable. It's so wonderful and amazing and perfect and excellent that nobody could ever write a chapter like it. In fact, they could never even write a verse like it. First of all, it's highly subjective, of course. I'd be interested in meeting someone who actually reads it in any language other than Arabic who says, oh yeah, this is the best book ever. It's a hot mess. It's not in any sort of helpful order. It's difficult. There's this principle of reading it called abrogation, where something that was revealed later that contradicted something that came before it replaces what came before it. So there were contradictions already within the 23 years that it was revealed to this one man in secret. It's already changing. Right, the eternal word of Allah is already being changed in a 23-year period during which Muhammad supposedly lived. And so this is also, it's actually factually untrue, even though reading it and concluding that it's beautiful is subjective. But people have gone to the Middle East and read the Bible, the Psalms, other parts of the Bible, in a classical Arabic style and language. And en masse, people did and do confuse it with the Quran. And so it's plain wrong to say that it's inimitable when Muslims themselves can think that the Bible is the Quran. What is beautiful is the Arabic language. It is, and that too, of course, is subjective. So I want to look at 4 additional criteria for reliability. I mentioned, so we had multiple attestation, multiple sources was kind of the first thing that we looked at. And of course, if a lot of people say that something happened, it's generally more reliable than if only one person said something happened, all other things being the same. We have four other criteria for historical reliability that come into play here that I think are interesting, helpful, and I chose ones that all start with E so that they're easy to remember. We have eyewitness attestation. So the gospel accounts were based on eyewitness testimony. Matthew was a disciple of Jesus, so he saw things firsthand. The gospel of Mark is based on the eyewitness testimony of Peter, who saw everything firsthand. Luke was based on the eyewitness testimony of several whom he interviewed, and of Paul, with whom he traveled. And John, of course, was one of the inner circle of three disciples who also saw everything himself. Throughout the Gospels, we also have numerous people mentioned who were there at the crucifixion, who were eyewitnesses. And when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, he said that most of the people who saw Jesus alive after having been killed were still alive, and so you could just go ask them yourself. If this was not true, the gospel, the whole thing would have fallen apart very early on. We also have early attestation. One of my favorite passages in the New Testament comes from 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 8. Verses 3 through 6 are an ancient creed. Paul did not write these. He is sharing a creed. It'd be like if I shared with you right now the Apostles' Creed. I'm sharing something that long predates me. So Paul was sharing an ancient creed as he was writing to the Corinthians. And it says, so Paul's words are, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received." And then he goes into the creed, "that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at the same time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles." And Paul says, "last of all, as to one untimely born, he also appeared to me." And so there are numerous reasons why historians, even non-Christian historians, will say, yeah, this is certainly an ancient creed that predates Paul, and it even non-Christian scholars will say this goes back to 6 months to 3 years, within 6 months to 3 years at the most of the events themselves, the crucifixion and the resurrection. Most people think that Paul probably received this from Peter and James when he went to visit them in Jerusalem after his encounter with Christ, and that's recorded. We have that recorded in Galatians 1, 18 and 19. So that is pretty cool. So this is exceptionally early. There are several reasons why scholars agree that this was an ancient creed. First of all, Paul's introductory comment, "I delivered to you what I also received," was kind of a way of denoting the impartation of oral tradition. Also, verses 3 to 5 appear to be Aramaic in origin, which is, you know, which indicates it was very, very early, the original language of the disciples. The text's content is stylized like a creed, and it's non-Pauline language. If you study the original language, you see, okay, this is not the way Paul wrote at all. Those are a few of the reasons. You can get entire thick books on that, though. Gary Habermas is a great source if you're interested in that. And there they are. We also have enemy attestation. So, in other words, if your enemies agree with you on something, especially on something related to your rivalry, then it's considered more reliable. So that's exactly what happened here. When Jesus' disciples began proclaiming that they had seen the risen Jesus, that the tomb was empty, things like that. The enemies of Jesus did not say, well, how can someone rise from the dead without even dying? He didn't die. How could he rise? They didn't say that, right? They didn't say, well, he probably left town. It's about time. They didn't say that. They said the disciples must have stolen the body. So even his enemies there are implicitly agreeing he had been killed. He had died. Okay. By the way, this is also, that enemy attestation is also evidence for the resurrection as well, not only the crucifixion. If when the disciples started proclaiming the empty tomb, if Jesus' body was not missing, they likely would have said something like, "The body's not missing; it's in the common grave." How can you proclaim he's missing? Like, if we threw him in the common grave with everybody else, or they could have said, "Well, no, we left him up on the cross," which is like what Bart Ehrman, skeptic extraordinaire, claims. Oh, they just left the body up on the cross, and the birds ate it. Well, that's how the enemies of Christ would have replied: is that his body is still up on the cross? The birds have been eating it. Like, everybody can see it. What are you talking about? But that's not what they said. They could have said, well, his body's right there where we put it, in the grave of Joseph of Arimathea, or wherever they put it. But again, what they actually said was, the disciples must have stolen the body. So again, they are admitting that the body was missing. We also have embarrassing attestation. One example of this is that women were the first witnesses to the empty tomb and the resurrected Jesus. And as the women were proclaiming what happened, and women were not considered trustworthy, reliable sources of information in the first century in this culture, their testimony was not permitted in a court of law. And so this, if you were going to make up a story, you would not make this up. If you felt free to doctor the story, change it even a little bit, you would have changed that immediately. Leave out the women. Say it was the men who found the empty tomb. The men, however, what were they doing? They were hiding behind locked doors out of fear for the Jewish leaders. Okay, so talk about making yourself look terrible. That's embarrassing. And yet, it seems that they did not feel free to adapt the story or the account of what happened. So they made themselves look stupid, they made women the heroes, and that actually was a stumbling block in the first century for people to accept, to realize that this message was true. Because, oh, you want me to trust a bunch of women? Nice. But what I love about that is that is strong evidence in the 21st century. Because now we can look back and say, yeah, that was embarrassing. They wouldn't have made that up. And so that is actually evidence today. Additionally, death by crucifixion was shameful, reserved for the worst of criminals. Certainly not what you would want or expect of your expected conquering king. You would not want to follow someone who was murdered, who was killed on a cross in the most shameful death possible and go, yeah, that's my Lord. So embarrassing attestation. When we contrast this with Islam, on eyewitness testimony, there's not a single eyewitness. Like I said, it requires us to trust someone named Muhammad who could not do miracles, whose contemporaries questioned his reliability, whose only supposed confirmation was the inimitability of the Quran, who came along 600 years after the event and claimed to know what happened 600 years before he was alive. Muhammad also, by the way, initially knew and wrote shared that he believed he was visited by a demon in the cave and that he was demon-possessed. So we are expected to trust a man who believed he was demon-possessed, and then it took some time for him to become convinced that, oh, yeah, I'm a great prophet. Yeah, it was an angel. So, and of course, Islam, the whole message of Islam, as I read it, is just, oh, goodness, this is exactly what we would expect of a human invention. Was that a time symbol or no? Oh, okay, good, good. All right, cool. We also have coherent historical context. So we know that a man, let me get his full name here. Publius Quintilius Varus crucified 2,000 Jews in a response to a revolt in Judea in 4 BC. So in the what we have is just historical evidence that crucifixion happened to rebels. Jesus was a potential political threat in Judea, and the gospel's depiction of Jesus' crucifixion fits the context of Jewish-Roman tensions. So so the historical context completely fits. We also have archaeological evidence that confirms that the Romans crucified rebels and slaves and criminals during the first century in Judea. In 1968, archaeologist Vasilios Seferis discovered the remains of a man named Jehohanan in a Jerusalem tomb that dates to between the first century BC and the first century AD. So right in there, in the time of Christ, we have the discovery of the remains of a man whose heel bone was pierced by a 7-inch nail, iron nail, which when they discovered the remains, the nail was still in the heel bone. And so they could see how this looked. And it was still attached to a piece of olive wood. So he had been crucified. His heel had been nailed to a tree, to a cross. The arm bones also revealed places where the nails had gone through. Both of his legs were also badly fractured, indicating a harsh blow to the legs, which we read about in the scriptures as the means, a common means of basically speeding up the process. And scholars believe Jehohanan was probably a political descendant against the Roman oppression. We also have a skeleton. Oh, this is cool. I've got pictures. So here you can see the bone with the nail still through it, and the piece of the tree. And for that third picture there, I think I may have found that on the internet, or I may have asked. I think I found that on the internet, but I may have asked AI to create that, given such and such information. And so, we also have the Gavello skeleton. In 2007, the skeleton of a 2,000-year-old man was discovered in Gavello, Italy, near Venice, and he had a distinct hole through his right heel bone, and there was significant skeletal trauma consistent with crucifixion. The skeleton was buried directly into the ground, so there was no tomb, no burial goods. This suggested that this was a marginalized member of society, probably a criminal. So again, these are just historical pieces of evidence that show that this all fits very much with the way things went historically with regards to crucifixion. We also have first century Jerusalem tombs. This is really cool. Between 37 BC and 70 AD, there was a very distinct way of creating tombs. And these, several of them have been discovered, so from right around the time of Jesus. And they correspond exactly with the biblical descriptions, the biblical accounts. And so, as we take a look at the photo of a tomb from Jesus' era on your left, this was uncovered during road construction in Israel. About 1,000 tombs like this one have been discovered from the first century and all around the region. Notice the large stone at the entrance, which was rolled across to seal the tomb. That should remind you of the description that we read about in the Gospels. Inside the tombs, there was usually a stone slab, which you see in the picture, where the body was wrapped in, it had been wrapped in burial cloth, and it would be laid immediately after death. After the body decomposed for a while, then they would collect the bones and put them in a bone box called an ossuary, so that there was room for the next person in the family who would die. And they would kind of stack the bones in the ossuary, the bone boxes, in the little niches to make room. So these archaeological discoveries match the description of Jesus' tomb that we find in the Gospels. So the Gospel of Matthew reports, quote, "When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a linen shroud, a clean linen shroud, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock, and he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there sitting opposite the tomb." That's from Matthew 27, 60 and 61. And so that really describes what we see here and what has been found in about 1,000 different tombs from that period in which this unique type of tomb was cut out of the rock. So these, again, confirm that the gospel accounts of Jesus are certainly plausible. They're certainly realistic. I'm not saying that this historical evidence proves Jesus was crucified, but that rather that it fits. As far as scholarly consensus, another useful I hesitate to even use scholarly consensus now, but I do think it's significant because the people I'm going to bring up here again despise Christianity. They've devoted their entire careers to trying to draw people away from Christ. They have no incentive to agree to the crucifixion unless they just cannot get away from it evidentially. And that's what we have in John Dominic Crossan, Bart Ehrman, Gerd Ludemann, Paula Fredriksson, and many, many others. And so John Dominic Crossan of the misnamed Jesus Seminar says, quote, "Jesus' death by crucifixion under Pontius Pilate is as sure as anything historical can ever be. For if no follower of Jesus had written anything for 100 years after his crucifixion, we would still know about him from two authors not among his supporters. Their names are Flavius Josephus and Cornelius Tacitus." So he's saying, yeah, this is as sure as anything historical can ever be. Bart Ehrman says this is one of the most certain facts of all of history. Gerd Ludemann, Jesus' death as a consequence of crucifixion is indisputable, non-Christian. Paula Fredriksson, single most solid fact about Jesus' life is his death, and she gives specifics. All of these specifics are basically indisputable. So what do Muslims say? I have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to get to that. The most common explanation that Muslims have is the substitution theory, right? That it was made to appear, the Quran says, it was made to appear as if Jesus was killed and crucified. He was not killed and crucified. Rather, Allah raised him to himself. So what happened? What did that look like? Well, a lot of Muslims believe that it was either Judas, in some like poetic justice, who was actually crucified, but Allah made it look like it was Jesus. Some say it was Simon of Cyrene. But either way, when I ask Muslims what made it appear as if Jesus was killed by crucifixion, they consistently tell me, well, Allah, only Allah could do that, make it appear, right? And so I think that raises an obvious problem. If Allah made it appear as if Jesus was crucified and killed when actually he wasn't, by making the eyewitnesses' own eyes and ears unreliable, Allah is the greatest deceiver imaginable. Allah is personally, actively, intentionally responsible for Christianity and for leading astray the millions or billions of souls that Muslims say, you know, are going to hell because of following Jesus, right? Allah, as it turns out, actually in the Quran, on two different occasions, boasts of being the greatest of deceivers. Who does the Bible say is the greatest of deceivers? Yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence. Going back to the story I shared at the beginning with my friend in the museum, and she said, oh, Jesus wasn't killed or crucified. I said, what happened? She said, it just looked like it. I said, who made it look like it? She said, Allah. I said, well, then that makes Allah a great deceiver. You can't trust your eyes. You can't trust your ears. You can't trust the Quran. You can't trust Allah. And her husband was with us, and her face kind of went white, and she turned to her husband, and she starts speaking in Dari, and he starts speaking back, and they're going, and they just start kind of losing it in their own little discussion. I'm like, is everything okay? And they're like, we will go now. And so we left. And you know, one of the important things that I like to keep in mind when discussing things like this with Muslims is don't believe that their initial reaction is their final response. I guarantee you they have thought about that conversation many, many times since and are trying to figure out what to do with it. I actually know this for a fact. And so may the Lord show them who he truly is. There's also no evidence for the substitution theory. The eyewitnesses who were present knew Jesus well. And there's no motive or explanation for why Allah would have done this. I mean, the story goes that Allah deceived people into thinking Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Christianity was created. Millions of people become Christians. 600 years later, he decides to send his correction book. Why? No explanation is given. He just decided it was time, right? I guess the full number he really wanted to be deceived, and I don't know. There's no explanation that really makes sense. A secondary, far, far, far less common belief among Muslims is the swoon theory, that Jesus was put on the cross, but he passed out. The biggest problem with this, I believe there are many though, but the biggest problem with this is that if Jesus had passed out on the cross, he would have died very quickly. Because on the cross, with the arms spread out in the way that they would do it, he'd have to lift himself up. He'd have to push up against the nails in order to exhale. And then he could come down and inhale again. If you watch him for about 2 minutes and he doesn't lift himself up, you know he's dead, right? So if he had passed out on the cross, he would have died. And I think the substitution theory and the swoon theory and knowing how to respond to those are both important. They're not only raised by Muslims. They are raised by agnostics, atheists, Buddhists, etc. as well. So I want to just close with this. We can know from the evidence, from basic common sense, from the problems that we see with the Quranic explanation, that Jesus of Nazareth was crucified 2,000 years ago. The evidence all supports that. It is one of my favorite topics to engage with Muslims. Virtually all historians of all worldviews agree to this. Muslims are basically on their own with this, unless you come across someone who doesn't believe that matter actually exists or something like that, like the Gnostics believed it was evil or whatever. But that's very uncommon. Basically, Muslims are alone in this one in believing that Jesus was not crucified, and even a lot of Muslims are starting to say, okay, well, he was definitely crucified, but so we're going to have to figure out a different way to interpret the Quran, and that is happening as well. If Jesus, again, was not crucified, but it just was made to appear so, then Allah is the greatest deceiver ever to exist, and we cannot trust anything we think, we see, or know. But the truth is that Allah, of the Quran is the greatest deceiver. He is the enemy of the truth. He is the father of lies. He is the destroyer of souls. And everyone needs to know this. So let's go out and tell him.